Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. I'm here with Selby Carey from Castor Space Technologies. Say hello.
Hi there. How are you doing, Bharath?
Right, so we're going to talk today about the company that you've started, building RoboCop, your journey from Africa, starting up, you know, being a young entrepreneur in Scotland, and how, and essentially how you've built this business and really quite an impressive business in such a short period of time. So do you want to give a little bit of background about yourself and how you started the business?
Sure. Maybe just to give you a bit of background on myself, I'm originally from Zimbabwe. I grew up in Zambia, and then I came across the UK when I graduated from school to study mechanical engineering. I graduated that about 2 years ago, and I'd worked with about three companies doing internships. I then didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, and then I sort of took the leap into entrepreneurship because we had developed an interesting piece of technology that we then went on to commercialize. I spent the next sort of 9 months building out the idea that we had to develop this business, and I worked for a bank in that period of time. And then I took the leap of faith, you know, I quit my job, I took out a wee overdraft, and 2 months later I was awarded an RSE Enterprise Fellowship. So the RSE is the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and that really helped me get going. And that was the first time I could go full time for the business, and that was about 15 months ago. And since then, you know, it's been sort of all things go, really. And the company's been growing, and we've been growing, we're building out the team.
So you mentioned it's not just you in the business, right?
Right. So I started with my co-founder, Michael. So Michael was also an engineer. He studied mechanical electrical engineering at Edinburgh University. I guess we've been friends now for what, maybe 4 or 5 years. And there's a bit of a funny story actually about how Michael and I met. So we were at this sort of networking event called the Edinburgh Apprentice, very similar to the one you see on TV, except it's for students. And one of our team members had not turned up that day. So we're walking around the bar where we were all meeting initially. And, you know, we needed a team member. And we saw this guy walking over to us. So we kind of waved him over. And as soon as he started speaking, I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "Zimbabwe." And I said, "Well, where'd you go to school?" And he said, "Rozawi," which is just so happened to be where I went to school. And I was like, "No, you're lying. It can't be." And we found out that the year that I left, he arrived.
Right.
So we knew all the same people. We studied the same course pretty much, and you know, we've sort of been friends ever since. We've been coming up with crazy ideas since we first met each other, and you know,
it's just kind of how it goes. It was just a couple years ago, right?
We met.
Yeah.
Michael and I met, I think, in 2015.
Right, okay.
We ended up actually doing the officer training corps, not together, but separately. So we were kind of in officer cadets while we were at university, so that was interesting for us. So we've kind of led sort of the same sort of lifestyle, except Michael's more technology focused than I am, and I'm quite interested in more on the commercial side.
All right, so what do you do? What is this business?
I knew we'd eventually get here. So what we build is autonomous surveillance robots that monitor and patrol large-scale perimeters 24/7 that provide our customers with accountable, accessible, and affordable security. Basically, as you mentioned, we build security robots. So these are unmanned ground vehicles.
Without the guns, though.
Without the guns, yeah, they're not too crazy. But basically what they do is they augment your current facilities. So what you've either got, if commercial facility, is fixed cameras, which are mounted on the walls, or you've got manned patrols. The problem with fixed cameras, obviously, are that they're static. And as your perimeter sizes grow, so does the cost of your maintenance and the capital cost to invest in these cameras. Whereas with manned patrols, unfortunately, I'm human as well. I recognize my limitations. You know, I can't see in the dark. Unfortunately, I can't collect data through my eyes. I can't stream that live. And unfortunately, sometimes I make mistakes, so I'm not reliable. Whereas our devices do that. You know, just to have one person on your site 24/7, you're looking at a minimum monthly cost of £12,500. For most companies, you know, unless there's a very high risk, high value asset that they're protecting, you know, they can't afford it. You know, one of the distilleries that we operate with, they have 4 sites and only one of those is manned. You know, the sheer cost of employing people is a problem. Doesn't mean we're replacing people, but we're just providing you with an alternative so you can protect this perimeter. Because as human beings, our the best aspect behind us is our ability to make decisions and to use analytical thinking to create innovative solutions to problems. And that's kind of where that people do sit in the security industry. You know, when something happens, then you respond. But you want to know when it happens, how it happens, and what the real issue is. So before you send the police or the fire services to a site, you want to investigate whether the alarm actually has been triggered by a fire, or whether, you know, your alarm has been triggered by someone trying to breach the perimeter rather than a rabbit or a fox, you know, because these breaches can be quite expensive. So we found a way to, you know, augment that, and we've started working with clients, and we're looking to deploy our devices within the next 2 months. So it's been quite an exciting journey. And this has all really happened over the last 15 months. You know, since we went full time, things really started hitting the ground. And I'd say about 9 months ago, we hadn't quite found our feet in the market. But once we met a couple of key clients, one of which is Edinburgh Airport, you know, things really changed for us. And we were able to start building devices that really fit up our customers' needs. And we just sort of gone, I guess, from success to success.
So it's not something you come up with every day, right? No one, I don't know, not many people I know would come up, get out of bed and say, I want to create a perimeter security autonomous robot. So how did that actually start? I mean, where did the idea germinate from?
I guess, you know, it's not really been as clean cut as most people. You know, we didn't go out into the market and then investigate that and so on and so forth. We built a product first at university. We built a self-stabilizing wheel. Which you'll find on our website if you go to Castor Spare Technologies.
So that's actually like a, what's it called? It's a single cycle wheel, right? So
yeah, it basically unicycle. Looked like a unicycle, yeah. Except it used variable pitch propeller blades to maintain its balance. A bit like a drone, but you know, you flip it. And that was quite interesting. However, you know, it had problems with battery life, had problems with payload. So we started commercializing that first, and we worked with clients and we realized what they wanted. You know, we took our product to the market.
Was that when you built that, was that actually specifically for security?
No, so it sort of kind of turned out, so in my master's project, we had this really interesting piece of technology. So I built that with a group of students, and you know, we graduated, we won the BP Prize for Best Master's Project. You know, I graduated top of my year, got some fantastic marks for it. But we definitely saw there was something there. Like, we didn't know where, but you know, we knew there was something. And that's why I said we spent the next sort of 9 months looking into different markets. And then we eventually sort of kind of found out that cinematography would be a great starting point, because you get a new angle, you know, you've got a new product in the market, you know, it's quick and it's fast moving. But then after going to Shenzhen and obviously learning a bit more about our competition and the competitive landscape, we realized that cinematography wasn't for us. So about 12 months ago, we took the plunge. You know, we revitalized the business. We did a full design session. We strategically looked at all the markets that were out there. We went and spent the next month, you know, just really speaking to every single customer we could find. And eventually I had a call with one of our key clients right now, one of our sort of installers. And as soon as I sort of pitched the product to him and what we could do, he just said, yes, 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 I can see what this is using. And, you know, we spent the next sort of months really speaking to some of the people, the key players in the industry. And from then on, it was just sort of as if the fire had been lit, you know, the rocket has taken off. And I feel like unlike most businesses, we kind of just fell into it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was, for those fans of the podcast, I will have listened to mine with the ANI Connects. And one of the things we say that usually the whole building it and they will come doesn't work. But in your sense, actually, you did build it and you found the people and they came.
The product we have now is, you know, different to the first one we presented because, you know, it's, I guess it's much better. It's been optimized. But I guess what we believed in was that the technology we'd built and what we were trying to do, our overarching vision, you know, that was still sound. And there was a really key piece of advice I once was given, which was whenever you find a hurdle, you come across a problem, you know, take one step back, you know, and keep taking steps back until you find a point where everything makes sense. And then you work your way back in. So for example, you start with your vision. So our vision, overarching vision, is to empower humanity through autonomy. You know, myself and my co-founder, we both worked, you know, a number of different jobs. And the one thing we realized was that repetitive data collection, repetitive tasks, you know, were just no value to us as human beings. And actually, you know, demoralized us even more when we did those tasks because that we're not good at that. We're not good at doing the same thing over and over again. So we knew that that was our overarching vision. We then took it a step forward and said, well, what do we want to do? Well, we want to make the world a safer place. You want to make data more accessible. And we also knew that in doing so, we wanted to enable access to robotics because robotics is what allows you to do this autonomy. I worked for a robotics company for a bit and I learned a lot about how that actually applies into everyday life. So if we kept breaking it down and then we in terms of finding where we fit, you know, we looked at all the markets. We looked at what it would cost to penetrate them, the investment we would require. We looked at, you know, strategically how would that place ourselves. And it sort of all came down to a very interesting conundrum, which was if you start as a security company, right, and you produce a robot that is highly secure, can transmit data, is, you know, is multi-terrain, you know, can carry heavy payloads, is autonomous, it's got, you know, a data collection platform on top of it as well. And then you go into another market, it's much easier because you've got this trust behind you. You know, everyone trusts you. You know, there's a lot in the news recently about cybersecurity attacks and yeah. all the different things and how at risk we truly are from outside forces. So if you build a security company from the ground up and you build those layers, you know, the rest of the world or the rest of the markets are a lot easier to enter them.
So you don't see yourself. So the product you've got is called Mantis, right?
So the product we've got right now is not called Mantis anymore. Okay, okay. So we've recently done a brand refresh. Like I can't tell you the name of the product just yet.
Is it called Vairav?
maybe we'll see. We'll see Vairav, you know. But yeah, we decided to do a brand refresh. I think it came at a pretty good time. We initially filed the trademark, you know, that got disputed, and it was probably the best thing that ever happened to us. It's actually one of the things that we say to people is you have no idea what the future holds, right? You can try and predict it as much as you want, but the only thing you can guarantee is that you're going to be wrong, right? You've got to be wrong. And if you're happy with that uncertainty, then you'll put some plans in place to ensure that you can overcome it. And the name Mantis was just, you know, a name that came up to us when we first had the single self-stabilizing wheel because it looked like a mantis with a cover on. It looked like its face with the pincers. And then we've actually spent the last 3-4 months really, you know, delving deeper into our brand and who we are and what we're trying to do. We will be announcing the new name very shortly.
All right, so do you, I guess the point of my question was really, do you guys see yourself as a security company at the outset, or is the product defining the business, or as you said before, making the world a safer place is your key goal? Are you going to be looking at other areas in which you can make the world a safer place?
You can only truly focus on one thing at a time, right? So today we are focused heavily on security because we believe that what we're doing will make the world a safer place. Whether it's collecting data in areas which are quite dangerous or hazardous for human beings to be in, or whether it's an area where we can provide better information to allow people to make better decisions about security. And that's a good starting point for us. But at the end of the day, we are a robotics service company. We've pulled together third-party software products for our customers to subscribe to. We've pulled a navigation stack and we've built on top of that. So everything we build is modular because you realize in this world that value trumps products, right? You know, it doesn't matter what product you have today, it's about what value that drives for your customer, because tomorrow your product might be different. And I'm sure you probably know this with your own business that, you know, it's a progression, it's, you know, it's an optimizational stage, right? You build one product, you then go to the market, or you work closely with the customers, and that product then changes and it changes and changes. And eventually you have this MVP. And once you go to the market, you have an opportunity to build on top of it. So to cut down the costs, we've made sure we've been able to build modularity in every piece, whether it's the hardware, the software, whether it's the navigation or the transmission. So we've built that in so that one day when the time comes, you know, whether it's an agricultural based software company who says, can we deploy one of our pieces of data analytics onto your platform? We say, yeah, sure, go ahead. And then what we do is we rent our devices to maybe one of their end clients. And slowly but surely, we organically can grow into these multiple markets because we've built a database of softwares from, you know, cinematography to agriculture to security, which is our key focus, you know, at least for the next three years.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I think going back, as you asked about you know, one of our businesses, I think if you look at Atom Ventures in itself, you know, we launched with a number of different offerings, and as time went on we refined that down to a more or less a single offering that is easily repeatable, and that process is there, and then you can actually switch out CTOs as CFO. So you can actually, as long as the model is straight there, and you know, as you say, you've got the underlying building blocks for that model, and you just replace certain blocks with some other blocks, and then you still have that core process that you can repeat and rinse and repeat and scale. Right. But you're just doing slightly different things, but are still part of that core vision, which was, you know, helping business with technology and operations, etc.
So, exactly. So, you know, I learned from working for large organizations. I've worked for 5 in total. You know, I'm still quite young, and I've gained a lot of experience from working for them. Mostly learning about what not to do, right? So as your business grows, you'll have problems with scaling, with, you know, growing pains, so to speak, hiring people. You know, there's a mountain of problems, you know, as your business sort of grows, but you can overcome them, right? But what you need to do is you need to remember that those problems will come and they're unavoidable. So can you put methods in place today to save you time later on? So every single part of our business is automated. I mean, from the payroll, to communications, to submission of documents, to document storage, everything. Anything that could potentially have administration costs or time associated with it has been removed. And we use external softwares. Like there's a great one called PeopleHR. I think you charge like £4 a month per person.
There are other softwares available.
There are other softwares available. I'm not advertising for them. But that one software, for example, it works well for me. And it removes all the administration time and costs associated with managing people's documents and, you know, their holidays and so on and so forth to a third party. That does very well. And for, you know, a fraction of the cost and the time that I is. So I always work on a time basis. I think, how much time have I got in a day? And what can I do with that time? And then how effectively am I using it? Again, this is another quote that I got told, but I thought was probably the most useful in my life, that there's a big difference between efficiency and effectiveness. Efficiency is how fast you can climb a ladder, so how quickly you can get to the top, and effectiveness is on what wall you put it on. So you could, in effect, be climbing in the wrong direction very quickly. So if you don't stop or if you don't look around you, you know, you might be climbing in the wrong direction. And that can completely destroy your business. So we did that for the first, you know, 9 months in reality, if you think about it. But we wouldn't consider that as a wrong direction because we look back on it now and say, well, what we did actually enabled us to build the product now. The reason our product is so low cost, you know, is so high performance is because we built a product for cinematography. And then we realized it didn't suit that market and we went to a new market and then we work with customers there and then optimize that to build what we have today. So we will inevitably have the most low-cost, high-performance, multi-terrain robotic vehicle with a modularity in tow to give our customers complete customization of this vehicle, something that's never been done before. But will be copied, right? We know that. But we've done it in such a way that we know from the ground up that we can build on top of it. And that one day that, you know, someone else might come over to us and say, listen, we've got a great software for this, or we've got some great autonomy, or we've got a great piece of hardware that you could potentially add to your platform. Fantastic. We're all open. Because at the end of the day, what the value that most businesses should aim to bring is the value to their customers. And if we're not doing that, then we're not good business.
So what's interesting is that you've mentioned a lot of different quotes and pieces of advice that you've been given over the, you know, the last couple of years. And, you know, having talked to you before, it seems that you were very early to create an advisory board, executive board, quite well experienced board. Now, how important has that been to you over the last 15 months? And how did you actually go around doing it? Because some of the guys that you've met are quite high powered. So, you know, was that through your network?
network. I mean, I go to, and you'll know this because that's how we, I guess, met as well, was I go to 2-3 events a week. Right. So my job, as it was told to me once upon a time, as CEO, is to bring home the bacon, hire people smarter than me, and clean up the SH1T. Oh. Right. So whenever something bad happens, I get called. You know, making sure the people that join into the business, whether advisors, chairman, and so on and so forth, that they are the right caliber and that we have the funds and we have the direction to move forward. Obviously, the rest of my job is strategic thinking, planning, and making sure things are getting done. Right. But when it came to the advisors, you know, we all sort of sat down and said, well, what are the gaps in our team that we do not have? You know, what are the areas in business that we do not know very much about? Because the most important thing to me is that I admit my ignorance. You know, I don't know anything. I know nothing, right? I know something. And as I grow, I will know more. But if you admit that you don't know what you don't know, it's a good place to start, right? I can give you more quotes that people always tell me, but I'm going to try and avoid that for now. The point being is that I went to loads of different events and I spoke to people and I constantly, every single time I said, you know, they'd be like, oh, so what are you up to, blah, blah, blah. And I'd tell them, pitch the business. And then I'd say, well, you know, what we're looking for is this. I'd always have an ask. Every single time I'd always have an ask. So we're looking for advisors on this or advisors on that. And it just so happened that, you know, we met one person, another person. One of the people that has been instrumental in our journey so far, you know, was one of the first people to actually say to us, you know, be more ambitious or, you know, teach us the ways of the craft, of this sort of deal craft. It's a guy named Shoney McDonald. So he exited to a large US household name for a company called Emlad with a very high, you know, exit valuation, which was quite nice. But what he did say to us was, you know, consider your journey from now. You know, you're seeing maybe potentially 5 years down the line. You don't quite know. It's very fuzzy, but think about that in mind. But I met him because he did a speech. He pitched on, well, he spoke about his journey on stage. And then as soon as he got off stage, I walked straight up to him and I shook his hand and I said, hi, I'm Selby. And we're trying to do this. And, you know, I told him how big the market was. I told him everything. And he said, well, you know, let's have a coffee. And it's really that tenacity to to go above and beyond and to back yourself and say, listen, I need your help. I don't everything, but you know, would you mind giving me a bit of help?
So one of the things that I come across when you're talking to, well, not just entrepreneurs, but people in general, is that they have that reluctance to speak to people go up and cold. I mean, they find it very difficult. I know, knowing you, you find it quite easy, but what kind of advice would you give to someone who is finding it quite difficult to try and reach these people, because they may go to the events, but they don't feel comfortable talking to someone?
I think there's a lot to unpack there. You know, is it more that you don't want to speak to people? You know, is it, you know, you don't know which people to speak to? There's a lot to unpack. So I think the first step when you go to an event is to realize that you're going to an event for a reason, right? You're either there to listen to someone speak or you're there to network. If you're there to network, then what you have to do is you have to speak to people. If you have difficulty speaking to people, I find it's all about practice. You know, when you first get up on stage, when you first speak to someone, you know, it's like dating. You know, when you first speak to someone, you might be a bit, you know, nervous, but the more you do, the better you get, and the more comfortable you find in being able to pronunciate yourself or being able to articulate the way that you mean to articulate something, right? You know, where you come across. And I think it was Warren Buffett who said that the most important skill they ever learned was how to communicate, right? Number one is communication. So before you can do anything in life, you have to be able to communicate what you want, what you need, and what you're trying to achieve to another person. So it really is about practice. Keep going after people and speak in different ways, you know, ask them for feedback and say, well, this or this. And eventually you get to a point where you become comfortable in being able to speak. And once you're able to speak, now you have to choose your words a bit more carefully. And our chairman, for example, is very good at choosing his words because he's an ex-diplomat. And I've learned a lot from him just being around him. And just the way he pronounces his words, what he tries to say and how he tries to say it in such a way that he doesn't offend anyone. And then he picks and chooses his words to ensure that he gets the biggest value out of every single sentence. And that's not something he's told me. I've just sort of picked that up from him. So that's been quite good. And that means sort of when you go to an event, if you are trying to meet these people, the one thing you can't control is you can't control who you're going to meet. Because, you know, you look at someone and they've maybe got a name tag or a big name brand on them. It doesn't mean anything because you actually don't know what their job role is. Maybe you get a sheet with all their names and their positions and so on and so forth. And that's great. But, you know, it'll take you a long time. You know, I generally work on a principle of I can meet up to about 10 people in an event, like up to. But what's more important to me is meeting high value people. And I treat every single person I meet as potentially being high value because you have no idea what will happen. Same as the ESC, the Entrepreneur Social Club that we go to and we're actually going to this evening. When we first started that, it was literally just a way for us to network without the work and to relax and have a pint with, you know, your mates who are also entrepreneurs and, you know, be within the same mindset because a lot of people don't understand what you're going through. And then one thing led to another and, you know, turned out that three of our investors for this new private round have been from the ESC group. You know, who knew? Mm. But every single person I speak to, I pitch the same way that I'd pitch to an investor. You know, I pitch in the same manner. I'm passionate about what I pitch about. You know, I talk about the key metrics that I talk about anyway. And what has happened is the people who I've been speaking to have just so happened to say, well, actually, you know, are you looking for any money in this round? Or, you know, can I get involved? And it's literally that's come across. So I guess the advice I would give to people is, you know, don't be afraid of coming across in the wrong way because you do not know who you're speaking to. And that person you're speaking to could be an investor, could be a future potential founder, employee, or could be the person who opens the door, you know, to the CEO of Reckitt Bekizna. You know, who knows? Who knows?
I think the other thing there is also that, you know, a lot of people are themselves being uncomfortable talking to people. So you may be another person talking to another person who's not necessarily as comfortable networking. And, you know, people are human. Everyone's essentially at networking events. Most times I've heard some horror stories, but most people are pretty nice and they're there to meet other people. So just saying hello, it's not like you're trying to date them. You just want to just go up and say hello, what do you do? And that's a simple thing. And people like talking about what they do if they do like
exactly. You literally just go up and you say hi. You know, when two people are having a conversation, I just walk up and say, hi, sorry to disturb you guys. Do you mind if I jump in here? Yeah. And generally they say, yeah, sure. You know, the people who are like, no, we're having a conversation, you say, well, that's absolutely fine. Best of luck. You move off. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we're all human. People say it about VCs and, you know, they think about them like lions or hyenas, basically. But at the end of the day, you know, there's still people who, you know, working jobs, who potentially have families to support. You know, they have their own wants, they have their own dreams. So if you treat people like people and you create that relationship, you know, you communicate with them. I don't mean like specifically in certain words, but, you know, you can create a relationship with someone that, you know, that feeling that you guys are on the same page. That's kind of what you need. And because at the end of the day, you know, most successful businesses are built on relationships, right? Whether it's your social capital or whether it's, you know, the relationships you've built during your business lifestyle, your customers, your installers, your partners.
Definitely.
So yeah, you can't, nice, you can't avoid it.
That's the other thing as well.
Yeah, be nice.
So you touched on investment just now. So you've been through a couple of fundraising rounds. Talk about a little bit about that process. How did you find it? What were the kind of key challenges that you found within those rounds?
I think the biggest challenge for me to start with was the fact that, you know, I came from an engineering background. So I, you know, thankfully I studied business. I did 4 years of business at school. And then I built single seat racing cars, or rather I was in the business team for a former student team at university where we built single seat racing cars. I did also work in the chassis team, sort of designing the frame or the structure of the car. But what I sort of kind of learned from that, and obviously doing some other extracurricular activities, was that business doesn't directly translate from a book into reality. And that was the first hard lesson for me, was like all the stuff I'd learned, sure, these are really interesting topics, you know, and you learn around them, you've got information. But really, you know, being a founder, you had to sort of learn on the job. You were constantly learning. Everything that you could potentially read about is great, but it doesn't apply in reality. You know, there's a lot you need to learn about. The same goes for investment. So you read all the books, you know what people want, you create the business plan. By the way, don't create a 60 or 70 page business plan with all your thoughts in it, because no one's ever gonna read that. That was the biggest mistake I think I made from that perspective. And the same goes for the presentation deck. You know, you download Sequoia Capital's presentation deck, you fill in all the things that they suggest there. I think the one thing that I definitely learned was you need to fit the investor as much as they need to fit in with you, right? So you need to recognize what they want, they need to recognize what you want, and there has to be this complete alignment. And a lot of the time we are so focused on raising money that we stop thinking about, is this the right thing for them? Is this the right thing for us? You know, there's two types of investment. There's hunger and opportunity. So hunger is when, like, oh, we've got this money, we need to invest it, and we're hungry to look for companies in this space. So we're actively looking, we're hungry. An opportunity is when a great, fantastic business comes your way and you go, well, we just can't miss this. This is just going to absolutely revolutionize things. And we've got to be in here, right? Now, most companies, you know, they're not that hungry, right? So they generally have a lot of companies come to them, pitching to them. So you need to recognize that you're one of very few. So I guess what I'm trying to distill it down into is the fact that you need to understand what you're communicating and how you're communicating and whether you fit. You need to understand that people are people, and therefore you need to communicate to them like people. So for example, the best kind of communication or the best way into any of these firms or angels or VCs is a direct introduction. If you know someone who knows someone and they say, actually, I back this company, please have a chat to them. That means so much more than anything else, because you don't have that much time in a day, right? So you've got 500 potential businesses. You're going to go for the ones that have been, you know, given that recommendation, that, you know, that gold star of approval. And the next step is all about the sort of deal craft, right? So that's something that, you know, I wouldn't say I'm that experienced in, but I've, you know, we've turned down a number of offers of investment because of, you know, poor valuations, and we briefly touched on this before. But you need to understand that as soon as you take someone's money, you know, your seed round, let's say, for example, it's like marriage or any hope of divorce. They are with you until the end. So be very, very careful whose money you take, because it'll always come with an ask. There'll always be something on the table there, you know, whether it's preferential shares or whether it's specific voting rights, or, you know, there's all sorts of things, right? And I'm not a lawyer, but I've learned enough to understand that be very careful and get advice. You know, before you make any decision, get advice. You know, take everything with a pinch of salt, of course, but, you know, get as many potential views as possible on the table before you decide on it. And my experience with fundraising has been that, you know, if you think it's going to take you X amount of time, you double it.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that, right? So yeah. Just double it. But what I base it on is in terms of, well, don't raise because you need to raise. Raise because you want to raise. There's a big difference in there. So need is like, oh, I'm going to run out of money. I need the money. Well, it puts you on the back foot. You're now desperate. And in reality, most people say, well, it'll take about 3 months to do the legals and negotiation. It takes about 3 months to actually do the sort of deal. It takes 3 months to build the relationship. So you're looking at 9 months before you can actually close anything in the bank. So you know that in the back of your head, but you build in 12 months. So by the time you're actually looking to raise investment, unless it's from a private individual or high net worth, or you know, you're in that point of opportunity where they're like, listen, we've just got to get into this deal. You know, we'll pull together a term sheet in 2 weeks because they don't want to miss out on it. Those are less likely, but it means that you sort of, you're constantly planning ahead and you're saying, oh, you know, let's create a relationship, let's chat away. But at the end of the day, you need to remember that you are raising this investment to do something with it. And if you don't have a plan to achieve something with that money that you're raising, you're not going to end out very, very, very good. You know, there are going to be problems along the way. So what we sort of did with our round was say, well, what do we need to get to the next inflection point? And this is something I kind of preach all the time. And this is all this information that I'm divulging to you. It doesn't just come from my own experience. It comes from, you know, countless advisors and people who have done this over and over again, you know, men and women who've exited businesses, you know, 20, 30 times, or grown companies up to, you know, 700 employees or more, made significant amounts of money. And what we sort of kind of distilled down to is make it to the next inflection point. What is the next step? And when I say step, I mean like step function, where, you know, you go from one position to the next, when you exponentially grow into another level. What is that inflection point and how do you get there? You know, how much money, how much funding, and what kind of funding do you require to get to the next point? So for us initially, it was, we needed to raise some pre-seed funding in order to bring on our team full time. So thankfully I got a Royal Society of Edinburgh Enterprise Fellowship scheme that paid my salary, and it also allowed us to bring on 2 interns. We then raised £30,000 from pre-seed tech accelerator Seedhouse based in Leith. And that gave us enough money to bring on another one. So we brought on another marketing director. So he helped us build out a business plan and really build out the business as such. Then my co-founder came on pro bono. We managed to sort of bootstrap with him because, you know, we subletted his flat on Airbnb, as he had a great landlord, let him do that. And he was sort of partially sponsored by his parents. So really we had to find a way to keep going forward. So then we said, what's the next inflection point? Well, the next inflection point was really, we need to get a prototype in the field and beta tests completed. So how much do we need to do that? Well, we thought we were gonna raise 250, then we thought we were gonna raise 750, you know, the number kept going up. And then what we ended up doing is bridging it with a small friends and family round. So we raised about, you know, 17K. And obviously, you know, that gave us what we needed to build the devices and deploy them in the field, which we've sort of done. And now we're at another stage in our round where we're raising another sort of friends and family or private round, a much higher multiple, but nonetheless. And what we kind of realized along the way was you need to get to the next inflection point and just do that. You know, you could raise a bit more, you could raise a larger fund, but let's say we tried to raise 750. We were quite, selective in our approach. I must have sort of pitched to over 100 different VCs and angels. Did get 3 or 4 offers from it, which was good, but we couldn't accept the offers because the valuation was too low. So the lesson we learned from that was you need to get to a point where you can defend a significant valuation in order for you to grow long term. Otherwise, you're selling, let's say, a third of the business early on. It's pretty much shooting yourself in the foot. For me, it's not about control or about, you know, how many shares I have. It's about direction. You know, is there enough on my cap table? Is there enough space, let's call it, enough space to bring on another significant party? And how do we grow together? And if they're going to start putting things on the table like preferential shares at an early stage and not wanting you to grow and they can't follow on, you know, this is somebody you're going to be with until exit. You know, you need to be careful of who you bring on. You'd be very selective. And that sort of, I guess, changed my mindset a lot, because before that I needed to raise investment because I needed to raise investment to grow. And then I said, no, we want to raise investment to grow and scale, but we can bootstrap, you know, we can leverage debt. There's other things you can do. And that change in mindset, you know, once we'd been rejected, you know, a number of times, once we'd been through that process, once we knew how to speak the language, you know, we knew the deal craft, it really changed everything. And we went from being, you know, 2 young guys trying to build a business to being, you know, a CEO and a CTO building a sustainable business. You know, we completely changed our mindset. Obviously, we had some great support, some great advisors. But now, you know, we're working with about 9 different investment partners, let's call them, none shall be named. And we have a £2 million deal on the table. So these are the things that we've had to sort of check on. And there's no chickens, there's only eggs. Like I always say, you know, loads of opportunities. You've not selected anything. We've not signed a term sheet. You know, being very careful with that. And we don't need to raise this sort of £2 million round until February of next year. So I've given myself 9 months. I know how the whole process works now. I've been in the trenches, you know, I've made the mistakes, and I'll be making more, I'm sure. But I know now what realistically is going to happen. And once you have that idea, that picture, and you've done it once, and this is why everyone talks about, you know, serial founders being a lot more investable, is because as a first-time founder, I was so naive. I'm still naive in terms of some aspects. But what we have proven since that last round, which is, I guess, I'm waddling here, but that last round, we realized what we needed to do. Our next inflection point wasn't just getting a prototype in the field. The next inflection point to get us to the next level, to get us to the next like layer, let's call it evaluations, was to get our products in the field and get some initial rental revenue. And that's what we're doing in the next 2 months. So we're raising a private round now to bridge the gap that I've just previously mentioned, to get us to that initial rental revenue, give us 9 months of runway, keep the team quite small, you know, to really sign some contracts with these clientele. We've got some big name brands who are going to be working with us, some international players, some, you know, some of the UK's best man guarding companies, you know, global installers and distributors. These are the things that have really drive that value up, right? You know, before, you know, trying to defend a £1.5 million valuation would have been difficult. Now, you know, it's in excess of maybe four times that. So that's the sort of journey we've been on. I've talked a lot about this specific issue because this is something I feel like a lot of people need to get into their heads, which is that you are in control of your business. You can decide what to do with it. Obviously, you're limited by resources and you're also limited by funds. And obviously, you've got time on your hands. And because of competitive forces, you need to, you know, to balance that all out. But you get to make the decisions. You get to make decisions when to sell and when not to sell. And you need to ask yourself the question, which is, you know, what kind of business am I going to be? What is my ambition? If you get your ambition straight first on, if you know what's out there, if you've done your research, if you've networked, if you've leveraged as much capital as you possibly can to get to your next inflection point, then you can keep working towards that. And that means that when you do decide to do a larger round, like, you know, a £2 million round, you know, you can defend a better valuation. You know, it's not always about valuation, but valuation does give you room to grow, right? And you want that, especially if you're a business like us, targeting, you know, the robotics as a service market, perimeter security with a global vision. We need to have room to grow.
Sure. All right, so going into the last question now. Usually the last question that I ask is, if you could go back 20 years in time and give yourself advice, what would that advice be? But given if you go back 20 years in time, you'd still be in nappies, right? So I think...
close enough.
So what I would ask then is, obviously you guys have gone through a huge amount in the last 15 months, and all the topics we've touched on are very, very important for all entrepreneurs trying to start a new business. The question really is then, what key piece of advice would you give to someone who is, you know, of a similar age that you were when you started your business and thinking about maybe straight after uni starting a business rather than going into a large company, or someone who's maybe started a job at a large company thinking, I don't like this, I want to do something new. What advice would you give to them?
I've got loads of points I would give up, you know, wish we had more time. But I guess that maybe that's the point I would say, you know, you have a limited amount of time. At the end of the day, your time is the most valuable resource. And as soon as you start treating it like a resource, your time, you know, let's say you can get paid minimum wage, or, you know, maybe your time is valued at £16 an hour or whatever it is, that is your time, right? If I'd learned early on that that was my time and that's how much value I can get out of my time, then you can leverage that and you say, well, I'm going to associate this much time to this project to do this. And as much as possible, make sure you spend that time early on, before, you know, you quit your job, before you leave uni even perhaps, you know, before you actually take this on full time and you make this a reality, right? Spend as much time as possible planning ahead, doing the research, figuring out what the ins and outs of your marketplace, speaking to your customers, finding out their pains and gains, you know, looking at the competition. By that, I don't just mean doing research online. I mean, like, really looking, like speaking to people, speaking to their clients and seeing how that works. Because end of the day, once you start a business, you're always limited by time. You know, you've got a runway, you know, you've got a certain amount of money in the bank and you're going to spend it. Or for example, you know, if you cannot work full time for your business, you now have to go and work another job, and then you lose that time on your business. So you need to be very careful about how to balance that. And I actually said to a friend recently, because he was asking about what to do before he starts a business, I said, you've still got a year left of uni. Spend as much time as you can thinking about exactly how you want to do this and what you want to do. And you know, the question I ask, you know, everybody, and I think I've my girlfriend probably hears this a lot, but you know, any success in life requires sacrifice. The question you have to ask yourself is, how much are you prepared for? And whether that means, you know, if you want to be a world-class musician or an artist, you know, or an engineer, you've got to sacrifice something. You know, when I was doing my degree, I sacrificed my social life, or, you know, I had to work a little bit longer, or I didn't have the same sort of, you know, work-life balance everyone else did. But at the end of the day, I came out of it with a master's degree in mechanical engineering. So I sacrificed something, but I got something out of it, you know? I mean, as soon as you accept that, and you accept the uncertainty of that, you move forward. So I guess the advice I would give myself, you know, going back, would be just to appreciate my time a bit more. You know, it's the one thing that I can't buy any more of. It's the one thing that I will never get any more of.
And you never get it back either.
I'll never get it back, right? So appreciate your time and plan ahead with it.
Yeah, great. Excellent, Lars. Well, that's been a very, I guess, very dense, but a very good podcast, I think, for anyone who's looking to start something up themselves and obviously wanting to learn about your journey. It's you've done a lot in a very short space of time.
Yeah, well, like I said, you only got so much time. Depends what you do with it, right?
True. All right, thanks, Albie.
Cheers, Barov.